This is KOOP HD1 HD3 Hornsby. Welcome to Civil Rights and Wrongs, the state of your civil liberties in the Lone Star State. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of the co-op board of directors, staff, volunteers, or underwriters.
The following program is homecrafted and was recorded on May 14, 2021. In March of this year, President Biden signed the American Rescue Plan into law. One of the provisions of this plan designated a record $3 billion in relief funding be given to historically black colleges and universities, or HBCUs, as well as other predominantly black and minority-serving institutions. In an interview with the media, Rodriguez Murray, a senior vice president for public policy and governmental affairs for the United Negro College Fund, emphasized the importance of this funding. Quote, "The investment the federal government has made in us is necessary for right now, but it's also a backfill for a lack of investment for so many years," Murray said. "The investments that are made during this pandemic are good because they're helping those institutions make it through one of the most uncertain times in American history. But they're also necessary to showcase how effective those institutions have been for decades, and during those decades have gotten very little investment. Yet they persisted with excellence, and with even more investment happening now, even more excellence is on the horizon," end quote. Additionally, in early May, Republican Senator Tim Scott of South Carolina and Democrat Representative Alma Adams of North Carolina co-sponsored the Ignite HBCU Excellence Act in Congress. Among other things, the bill would direct money to renovate and modernize buildings and infrastructure at more than 100 of the nation's HBCUs. According to Adams' information, the nation's HBCUs, most of which are more than a century old, have a combined $25 billion in estimated maintenance backlogs. As part of the White House's response to this proposed legislation, a spokesman said that HBCUs have been, quote, "historically underutilized and under-resourced," end quote, in research and development, and that the president wants to, quote, "ensure that we are tapping into the talent of those institutions," end quote. As reported in a 2017 economic impact study published by the United Negro College Fund, HBCUs generate $14.8 billion and 134,090 jobs for their local and regional economies. This report also stated that HBCU graduates earn 56% more than they would without college credentials. Good evening and welcome to Civil Rights and Wrongs on Co-op 91.7 FM in Austin and streaming live at coop.org. I'm Michelle Manning-Scott, guest hosting the program this evening alongside regular host Bob Daly and our frequent guest commentator Jim Harrington, retired founder of the Texas Civil Rights Project. Our guest this evening is Dr. Colette Pierce Burnett, the president and CEO of Houston-Tillotson University, Austin's oldest institution of higher learning and its only historically black college and university, or HBCU. Dr. Burnett became the first female president of the combined institutions of Houston and Tillotson Colleges in July 2015. In addition to leading the university, she is a strong proponent of civic and community engagement, as evident in her many leadership and committee positions within the Austin community. Welcome to the program, Dr. Burnett.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Well, we're glad you could join us. And we typically start the program off by having our guests introduce themselves and give a little bit of their background. So if you want to jump into that, that'd be great.
Of course. I am in my sixth year of my presidency. Actually, I'm coming to the end of my sixth year. I'll be moving into the seventh year. I started at the university in July of 2015. Right on the heels of leaving, my predecessor, Dr. Larry Urban, had been at the institution for 15 years. So I replaced a long sitting president, which is always a gift in many ways and a challenge in some. So I'm really happy to be here. I've learned a lot about Austin in the process. I've fallen in love with the students, with the campus. It's a very magical campus. So for all the listeners, please come and visit us. And we're fully online right now through the COVID-19, but we have started our reactivation plan to bring our students back in the fall, in August. And I'm actually really looking forward to that because the campus has not been the same without the students here. And I'm originally from Cleveland, Ohio, so I'm not a native Texan, but happy to be here now.
Well, we have that in common. I was born and raised in Cleveland also.
Oh, very nice. Where'd you go to high school, Bob?
I went to St. Ed's in Lakewood.
Okay. I went to John F. Kennedy.
Yeah. Well, great.
Small world in Texas.
Yeah. I have a PhD from Ohio State, too.
Well, we're really connected. I'm a true guy. Okay. Great. Very nice to meet you.
Yeah. I understand that you have kind of a mixed professional background, too. You were in academia previous to this appointment at Houston Tillotson, but you've also had some professional experience beyond that. Is that correct?
Yes, I'm an engineer by training. I got my engineering degree from Ohio State University. It was not the Ohio State when I was there, but from the Ohio State University. And I was an engineer for the first 21 years of my career. And my husband is a retired military officer. So his career was actually very good to my career because we lived in some really wonderful places. And I had some exciting opportunities to work for the Washington Post, Washington State Department of Transportation, et cetera. I would have stayed in Ohio my whole life, but I don't really think I ever wanted to be an engineer. I believe I went into engineering, Black, female, in the late 70s and quote unquote, and I put air quotes around good in math. So I was told to become an engineer and if you wanted to make good money, so I did. But I reached a point in my life that I wanted to follow a passion and education has always been a passion. So I took a leap of faith, transitioned and took a teaching position, teaching information systems at a community college, and then eventually transferred into an administrative position and have never looked back. I really love the science of higher education. Education truly is the great equalizer. So I have that corporate background. I have a non-circuitous path to the presidency.
And what did eventually bring you here to Austin and to Houston Tillotson? How did that come about?
The position. I've told the story many times. I was finishing up my doctorate. I got my doctorate late in life when I realized that I wanted to be a president. And being a Black woman in this space, if I did not have the credential of the terminal degree, my opportunities just weren't going to be there without that degree. I had plenty of what my son called street cred, where I really knew a lot about higher education, had been in it quite a while in several capacities, but did not have the doctorate. So I went back late in life to pursue my doctorate. And when I was finishing up defending my dissertation, I was recommended for the presidency at Houston Tillotson. So I actually threw my hat in the ring as a practice for a presidency because presidential searches can be really intense. So a mentor of mine, and I'm a strong believer in mentoring for this reason, a mentor of mine recommended that I just pursue it as a practice. So I was practicing through the process until I actually came on campus, met the students, met the faculty, met the staff, saw the campus, and fell in love with it. And I went from practicing to working real, real hard to get the position. So it is the position that brought me to Austin. I had never been to Austin before I came here for my interview.
Oh, well, so you kind of took the position sight unseen almost, it seems. So why don't we talk about Houston Tillotson then? Because I'm interested to know a little bit more about the history of the university itself and the combination of the two. Apparently, prior to it becoming a university, it was both Houston and Tillotson colleges that merged. What can you tell us about that?
Right. In brief, the two institutions, Houston and Tillotson, were respectively founded in 1875 and 1876. They merged into Houston Tillotson College in 1952 to pool their resources, because at that time, both were really challenged. It was a time of integration. So historically, Black colleges were starting to become challenged with recruiting students and other things. And then it became Houston Tillotson University in 2005. I think the most fascinating thing for me in the university's extraordinary history And this is a good moment for me to point out something I love to say is that we are actually older than the University of Texas at Austin. We were founded at a time when Blacks could not attend other majority institutions. That's really the premise. Blacks couldn't go to what we call now majority institutions or white schools. The fascinating thing for me is Juneteenth, when the Blacks in Texas found out that they were in fact, quote unquote, free, happened in 1865. And we were founded in 1875 and 1876. So that's a mere 10 years after the brutal institution of slavery was dismantled. And that just fascinates me about the courage and the tenacity that people had to work really, really hard to educate a people. And that mission alone is inspiring for me. So we have faith-based roots. We were founded by the United Methodist Church and the United Church of Christ. And even in the combining of the two institutions, our motto is in union strength. Our seal has two hands shaking, which represents the two institutions merging together. Many of our buildings have two names, which represents the two universities merging together. Where we sit now was one of the original footprints. And for those of you familiar with Austin, down at 11th and what used to be East Avenue, or now I-35, was the location of the other campus down in that area. There's actually still a marker there. It used to be where the CVS is. There's actually a historical marker there to designate that that was the original campuses and even in the combined institutions. And I'm actually the second female in the history of the two colleges, if you will. The first female was a woman by the name of Mary Branch back in the 1930s and into the 40s. She just really had to be a wonderfully courageous woman. And I believe that she probably was one of the first female presidents of a four-year granting institution in Texas, because of the time frame that there were very few female presidents at that time.
Yeah, I saw that information when I was looking at some of the history of the university, and I was surprised myself too. Wow, a woman, first of all, and then a Black woman on top of that, to have such a prestigious position back in that time. That was quite amazing.
She's one of the founding members of the United Negro College Fund and very active here in Austin. She was the president of the NAACP. A very courageous woman. She was from Virginia, Ivy League trained. She was an educator and found her way, which that part is a mystery to me. When I retire, I'm going to actually research that, like how she got to Texas, because she didn't have the internet and all of those things that we take for granted now to be able to get that information. But had to be through a very intense and a very close-knit network for her to make her way from Virginia via Chicago all the way into Texas.
Yeah. And so I didn't know hardly anything about Houston Tillotson. In fact, I hadn't even heard of it, to be honest, until I moved here in 2018. And then the fact that it was an older institution of higher learning than the University of Texas, too, that just speaks volumes as well. Also wanted to have you on because I know you're an advocate for HBCUs amongst, I'm sure, all the presidents of the HBCUs around the country. So wanted to ask what your take on it is and fill us in on some of that history, if you would.
Of course, I'd be happy to. I did not attend a historically Black college. I went to a flagship state school for my undergrad. I went to a regional school, Georgia College, in Milledgeville, Georgia, for my master's. And then I went to University of Pennsylvania, an Ivy League school, for my doctorate. So I've experienced the public world, the private world, the big state school, the smaller regional school, and then a school that prides itself on long legacy of education. And I have to say that there is nothing like the magic of what happens on a historically Black college. It is a safe harbor, a safe space where young people can come and be themselves and where standards are held very high for them. I really push back against this notion that Black people go to Black colleges because they can't go other places. That's just really ludicrous. And I live it every day. So I'm not just biased. I'm like a practitioner of it. We have no language of Black on our campus. You will not come to this campus and be told that you're less than, or you're a minority, or you're underserved. Some of those things may be true through some lens and in some perspective, but we call our students the genius generation because they truly are geniuses. They're just really wonderful, bright young people, hungry for knowledge and hungry to live a good life and be a strong citizen. And we weave social justice in everything we do here on my campus specifically, which is the case in most of my sister colleges. And it's because it's a reminder that you have a responsibility to go out there and be a good citizen and to go out there and be a change maker and a history maker. For me, my parents are the smartest people that I know. My dad grew up in Mississippi and was part of the Great Migration, actually ran out of town in Brookhaven, Mississippi. That's how he migrated eventually to Cleveland. And this man with a sixth grade education, he didn't get the opportunities that most people would have gotten. So I believe in my soul that the reason I'm so leaning into the Historically Black College mission is because it was those schools that gave people opportunities for them to be able to have a different trajectory in their life. My dad worked very hard. My sister and I thought college was the 13th grade. We had no option but to go to school because of his own work ethic. And if I had to do all over again, I would not go to Ohio State. I love being a Buckeye, but I really pushed hard for my own children to experience the Historically Black College experience. And my son went to Hampton University in Virginia, and my daughter, she went to a majority institution. So that makes a point that we're not for everybody, just like big state schools or small liberal arts schools are not for everybody. But we are one of the best options for young people, irrespective of your skin color, to come to a place that is truly diverse in and of itself, if not by race, by religion, by creed, by culture, by who you love, by your socioeconomic status, all these things. It's just a mix, a multitude of people where you're not judged by any means by the zip code you were born in or by the color of your skin. And someone's going to have very high expectations of you with a lot of opportunities. HBCUs have always been the centers of intellect, creativity, and solutions for the most pressing issues facing society and the world. And we see that right now with many of the quote unquote leaders in the movement of today that come from HBCUs, Historically Black Colleges, because they have this sense of self-efficacy and pride and continuity in their lives. Just like in the major civil rights movement of the 60s, many of those cast of individuals that did the work in that era were Historically Black College graduates.
And I may not be correct here, but it seems like during your tenure, Houston Tillotson has become even more immersed in the Austin community. It seems like there are more diversity events coming out of Houston Tillotson, and I've certainly become much more aware of it in the last 5 years. So I'm grateful for your own efforts in that regard.
I really appreciate you saying that, Bob. I saw Andrew Young speak at an event, and he said that there are no coincidences in life, that coincidences are God's way of remaining anonymous. And I don't think it's an anonymity or some by chance that I happen to come to Austin at this point in the university's history, given my own background and my own training and my own passions. So I ended up being a vessel for this time and this place in the university's history. And I'm super humbled by that because I've learned a lot. My students, I learn as much from them as they do from me. And in studying Austin's own history and with the 1928 plan and the university's role at that time and how the university was positioned in the discussions around that time, it fascinated me. And then at this time of civic unrest in our own country, I feel very strongly that the university has a role to play. We're an honest broker in these conversations to be able to dismantle racism, racist systems. And it's really not about racist people. It's always about systems. And colleges are those places to be able to have those really hard conversations. And by hard, I mean honest, appropriate, respectful, and direct conversations of really coming from a place to really wanting to build what Dr. King called a beloved community. So we've worked very, very hard for the university to serve that purpose while simultaneously we're building the plane while we're flying it, while simultaneously working to move the university into a space of thriving and building good, strong partnerships and opportunities for our students, because those two things go hand in hand. So that really fills my soul to hear you say that, because we've been working hard to lift the brand of the university and to build it to this space where people recognize what a jewel we are in Austin's violet crown.
I think back to last summer when the various Black Lives Matter marches and Chas Moore and AJC having that big event there, and then most recently, just in April, we had the organizers of the anti-Asian violence event on the show here. I was very pleased to hear that you were hosting it over there at Houston Tillotson.
You know, the Black Lives Matter March in June, if we processed that, that was 3-4 months into the pandemic. And we had closed the campus to on-ground learning, and students were not able to live in the residence halls. So when Chaz called me and said that they wanted to host the march here, my head said, oh gosh, no, my security people, my academic people, no, that's not going to fly. But my heart said, this is what we are about. This is who we are. We have to be the host of it. And it was one of the hardest decisions I've had to make, but one of the easiest decisions I've had to make for the campus to serve as a host. And someone had asked me, was I worried at that time? And I think when you make those kind of decisions that your soul is at rest, that this is the right thing to do for us to be able to open the campus up to that kind of movement and to kind of reemphasize that this is not a moment in history, it's a movement. And we all have to lean in, you know, push that moral arc towards justice. I said, like right away, out of my mouth to Chaz, said, I was actually honored that they asked us to be the host of the rally. And I said to Chaz, of course. And then I had to go back and deal with the people on the campus that were trying to hold the wire with us deciding to go fully online. I'd make that decision all over again. It was just a magical moment in Austin that engaged a lot of different people from a lot of different walks of life, showing commitment, a true intention to want to make our community a better community for all. And the Stop Asian Hate rally was the same reason Pooja had reached out to me and asked me, will we consider it? And I said, you don't even have to ask. Once again, we're honored. We want to be that center for that kind of synergy to be able to reside. And it's just a safe space for that. And everything is symbolic.
Yeah, I was happy to attend the Stop Asian Hate rally. It was my first opportunity to actually visit the campus. That was really great. And I look forward to future events there, too, now that I know where it is. And you clearly are getting the community engaged in many aspects, too. So that's really heartening to know that now that we're coming out of the pandemic, to have more of those opportunities.
Another really interesting thing is we are the host location for Earth Day in Austin. And that is the ultimate in diversifying my students' things that they're interested in. Because generally Earth Day is perceived as something that's, you know, mostly for white people, just to be frank and honest about it. And you don't really think about Black and brown people engaged in the kinds of activities that are on campus. So that's one of those exposures. And it was like an immersion in a different culture for several people. And that's a longstanding partnership. We really enjoy it. And the reason we were even invited into that conversation is because one of my passion projects on campus is environmental justice. We actually have an environmental justice major, because when we talk about social justice, equity, inclusion, belonging, all those kind of peanut butter and jelly words, and we talk about civil rights, it goes to all the tenets of life, and one of them being the environment, and how when we have these devastating crises events like floods, hurricanes, even the pandemic, the people that are most decimated and most affected are people of color. And rarely do you see people of color at the Corps of Engineers or people of color sitting in a room thinking through and making decisions about, you know, building bridges or building waterways. So we want to make sure that we diversify at all levels, because they come with lived experiences. It helps to make different decisions when you're from a neighborhood that was decimated or that was destroyed by a hurricane or by a flood or a tornado. So environmental justice, we all have to be concerned about that. And we want our students to walk in those different fields and those different spaces. So the two rallies are highlights, but Earth Day is another one of those examples of the university diversifying what our students are exposed to, as well as diversifying what they think about. We can't tell them what to think, but we can tell them what to think about. And that's been a mission of HBCUs for a long time.
We actually had Karen Magid on the show back in April.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, she's a superstar.
I'm still chuckling over the whole dumpster project. But
yes, yes. In fact, when I was in the interview process, I Googled Houston Tillotson University. And the only thing I found for the first two pages of Google was about the dumpster project and the professor, Jeff Wilson, living in a dumpster. thought to myself, oh, I know I don't want to work at a school where people are living in dumpsters. That really put the university on the map in some circles. And Drs. Karen Magan and Amanda Messina were instrumental in working with Dr. Wilson on that.
Well, Jim, you made that very point about the environmental movement. I think it was on that show, right?
Yeah, so this is a really intriguing conversation, or actually listening. I really appreciate creating the diversity of human rights, emphasizing that diversity. And I really appreciate looking at these issues as systemic issues, you know, that people who act in a racist manner are acting out of the system that we live in. And I think that's really important to understand. I'm over at St. James, and you probably know that St. James was founded by faculty from Houston at the time, right? For reasons of discrimination at St. David's. In fact, Bertha Means just died a couple weeks ago, the last of the founders. That tradition that they brought with them to create this diverse community in East Austin has been absolutely amazing, and a tribute to those folks from Houston at that time that made that jump. And then during the civil rights movement, made the decision to open the doors to everybody, that it wasn't going to be just a black church, but it was going to reflect the justice diversity in the community. And I was watching John Brewington, a good friend of mine, did a program a couple months ago. I don't remember exactly what it was about, but the students were talking, and it was really powerful to listen to them talk about how they were dealing with the pandemic and trying to form community during the pandemic. It really struck me about the thinking that the college students were going through and their emphasis on how to keep community going during the pandemic. It made me really understand that this was not only something with them, but also something that they were nurturing at Houston Tillotson. So it was quite impressive to watch that program. So I commend you for all the above, and I hope you'll be around for a long time, because we need to see Houston Tillotson become the human rights leader in the community for a whole variety of reasons.
Thank you. I really appreciate that.
We're speaking with Dr. Colette Pierce Burnett, the president and CEO of Houston Tillotson University, Austin's oldest institution of higher learning and only historical Black college and university, or HBCU. We need to take a short station break, but we'll be right back. Stay tuned.
Hello, Miss Manners here from Hip Hopery, just to drop in and let you know that you too could be a radio show DJ from home without pants on. Just go to KOLP.org and find out when our next volunteer orientation is. That's right, everyone right here in Austin, Texas, can train to be a radio DJ, because that's what we do. Again, KOOP.org. See you on the airwaves.
Welcome back to Civil Rights and Wrongs on Co-op 91.7 FM in Austin and streaming at KOOP.org. I'm your guest host, Michelle Manning Scott, alongside regular host Bob Daly. This evening's program was homecrafted and recorded on May 14th, 2021. We're speaking with Dr. Colette Pierce Burnett, the president and CEO of Houston Tillotson University, Austin's oldest institution of higher learning and only historical Black college and university, or HBCU. Let's continue.
Earlier, I had referenced making one of the hardest decisions when we chose to close the residence halls for the spring term and summer in that fall. The reason that was so hard is because this is like their home away from home in many ways. Students, they do build community. They have a lot of communities within community, but it's a strong bond. Our size attributes to that as well. And what we found was many students didn't have internet connection. All the disparities that we as a nation kind of sweep under the rugs were just really brought to the forefront as a result of the virus. And that was really difficult to navigate through as an institution. And in hindsight, we did it. It's miraculous that we were able to navigate through it. And it was not without pain points. We had everything virtual. We even had the crowning of Mr. and Miss HT virtual. We had our chapel services still held virtually. In addition to instruction, everything came online. So I would pop into some student activities that they were having in the evening time. And it just really warmed my spirit how they were holding on to bonding with each other. And so we have a deep sense of urgency to bring them back to campus because we want them to continue to persist because they can't afford to take a gap year. So it's the power of the community that encourages them to persist because, you know, they'll push each other in addition to what the university does and our structural ways that we push the university forward. I'm looking forward to them coming back to campus. We're committed to continuing to build that sense of community.
What's the enrollment looking like for the fall? Has that started to go up? I'm curious because the social justice movements that have been going on in the past year have brought light to all the different aspects of...
Right.
Actually, at the onset of the Trump administration, HBCUs started to see an uptick in interest. People are just now learning what we've always known. And it didn't hurt to have the vice president be a graduate of one of our sister institutions, Howard University. And that just really brings a lot of exposure to the mission. It's about time. That's how I feel, having been in this work and working with these schools for almost 30 years now. Well, when I said that out loud, that sounded crazy, but time flies, I guess, when you're having fun. But having worked with this particular mission for quite a while, we are very firm in our roots of being a historically Black college, but we have never discriminated. It's an open, welcoming environment for anyone that wants to have the experience of true belonging and inclusion. So we have our pain points and our bright spots, just like all other sectors of higher education. But to answer your question about enrollment specifically, we've seen an uptick in interest in coming to the university. We're really focusing on our students, getting them to return to school because many had to work to help their families, and we're in a sense of recovery. And people often say that our schools are super resilient, and we are, but at some point, resilience becomes abuse. Like, when do you have to continue to be resilient in order for you just to get what you deserve? And our students deserve this level of excellence in delivery.
So I understand that the funding has increased for HBCUs, in part due to Trump. I wonder if you all talk about what kind of direction or emphasis you all as a group are going to take into the future.
I wouldn't say our funding increased. I would say our visibility increased. We always have to advocate super strong for everything. Affordability is an issue in higher education in general. By nature of the population that we serve, especially a small private liberal arts school, 98% of my students are on some form of aid. The only full payers that I have, people that come pay the sticker price, if you will, the cost of tuition, are our international students. And that speaks volumes about the cost of higher education in this nation. So we are consistent, strong advocates to encourage the decision makers to fund higher education so that education doesn't become a private benefit. It stays as a public good so that people who make less than $30,000 a year can afford to send their children to get an education. Because education, as I say all the time, that statement, education is a great equalizer, that's just true. It gives people opportunities that they would not have had. The more education you have, the more opportunities you get. And particularly if you're a person of color, just the fact is in the nation that you need to have some kind of post-secondary education credential. Even if you decide, you know, to get a trade, you got to have a credential. If you decide to go to community college, you got to have a credential. So as a sector of higher education, it's a consistent advocacy for increasing funding, if you will, even if it goes directly to the students, for them to be able to afford an education. Here in Texas, we have the Texas Equalization Grant, which basically stays flat, and we have to continue to advocate for the state to be able to pour into these young people who want to attend a private institution and need to close that gap in what's called that Texas Equalization Grant. The Pell Grant, we as a sector, historically Black colleges, advocated for Summer Pell. Because you have a student that qualifies for Pell, because in my students' cases, many have an estimated family contribution of $0. If my family's income is $50,000 and tuition is $20,000 for the year, $10,000 a semester, that's just unrealistic to think that my family makes $50,000, or my mother or my dad makes $50,000. Their contribution to my education is zero. So I'm dependent on Pell. So we are consistent advocates for Pell to be increased. And we got it approved through the summer so that a student, if they're short on hours, they want to persist it so that they can stay on track. And they want to go to summer school, they need that Pell. Now we're advocating for Pell to be even doubled because it doesn't really cover the cost of tuition, $3,000-$4,000. But even at a state school, that doesn't help much when you add books, travel, just the cost of attendance. So a big part of it is advocating for affordability to be addressed as a nation because it is a challenge. And we work hard not to saddle our students with this tremendous amount of debt because they can never get their footing. The CARES Act money has been helpful because from a lack of investment for years, decades, almost a century and a half, really, to be honest about it, my buildings are old. My air filtration systems are old. The filter systems are old. So we're able to use those restricted dollars that come from CARES Act to prepare the campus for students to come back. So simultaneously, you have to stay state of the art. You have to stay current. So playing catch up, if you will, with deferred maintenance, which is a challenge in all of higher education, but specifically in historically Black colleges, while being creative and innovative to make sure your graduates are capable to take the jobs into the 22nd century. Texas has this 60 by 30, 60% of the population educated by the year 2030. And that was a goal pre-COVID-19, statistically, to be able to do that. The sector of the population is going to be poor people, people of color, people in rural areas that are not currently going to college, because middle income and upper income people are already sending their children to school. So you're not going to make any meaningful progress towards that goal of some post-secondary credential for 60% of the population by 2030 unless you address the affordability issue. But the human rights issue of it is, if you want the citizenry to get an education, they have to be able to afford it, and it has to be quality.
So I'm listening to the comments you're making, and I'm wondering if you look at what's happening in high schools these days in terms of moving into Houston Tillotson or college in general.
Yes. My son is a journalist. He writes for Education Week. And he writes a lot about the K-12 system. And he and I have had these conversations about where higher ed points to the K-12 system saying, you're sending us students who are quote unquote not prepared. And then the K-12 system points to higher ed and says, hey, you're not sending us top-notch classified teachers. So we're all pointing at each other, but we're really in this together. It is a pipeline. So we have strong partnerships with all of the ISDs in Central Texas. That was a part of my mantra from the very beginning. Paul Cruz and I, prior superintendent there at AISD, we ended up being co-chairs of the Mayor's Task Force on Institutional Racism. So we really spent a lot of time together and got to have a lot of dialogue about the challenges that we have and how we can handshake each other. I'm very excited about the current superintendent, Dr. Elizalde. She's doing a phenomenal job and has great vision for the district. Another one of my passion projects on campus is African American Male Teacher Initiative that's powered and funded by Apple. And it's a partnership that I'm extremely proud of. We are intentionally recruiting and retaining Black males to be teachers in the K-12 system. There's all kinds of data that shows if a child sees someone of their same culture, their same race, their same ethnicity, somewhere in their matriculation, they have a better chance of completing high school and persisting on to follow their dreams. So we want to be a part of that to build this pipeline. And Apple believes and has invested in it for those young men to be able to actually have scholarship dollars, programming, et cetera. And then as far as readiness goes, we do a lot of interactive partnerships back and forth with the school district with math. Everybody needs to take as much math as possible. So we need to be thinking about in creative and innovative ways to teach math. Career day. I myself have gone and participated in quite a few career days. Financial aid. We've started some FAFSA conversation with parents of young children because a family that first generation, no one in my family's gone to college. From the kindergarten on, I'm having conversations in my household about how unaffordable college is. So we want to start changing that narrative where if you work really hard, you keep your grades up, you do your financial aid forms, You work hard to try and find scholarship dollars. You can do this. It takes a lot of work. And there's that word again, resilience, but it can happen. So we want to change that narrative where people see college. I'm biased to a college education, but recognizing that not everybody's going to go to college, but we want to work as hard as we can to make sure that they see college as an option and something that even though you're going to have to work hard for the affordability, you can do this. There is such power in this persistence.
I don't know if you heard this yet, but AISD banned PTA teacher positions because the West Side, as you probably know, is funding position, particularly the arts, and didn't have any accountability and didn't even have to report it, but it created this unequal educational opportunity divide, among other things. But you're talking about steps that Dr. Lasala takes, and I think this is a very good step in that direction to equalize or to move in that direction, that these kids that on the West Side shouldn't have an upper step going into college because of the private funding of their high school education.
You know, it's back to what we were talking about earlier about racism is baked into systems where people are making decisions where that was not your intention in some cases, not in all, but in some cases that was not your intention, but there's an impact to it. And it takes a community to make these bold decisions and then stick to them and have the courage and the will. We got lulled to sleep back in the 60s. We thought we'd arrived because we had equality, but we didn't reach equity. And that's something very different. So then we have these moments where we get all riled up and then people go back to sleep. They go back to their privilege and they don't want to see it. You don't want to be engaged in it. And therefore, you don't have to do the work. It really takes a lot of self-reflecting, a lot of heart work to think through how is this making this system inequitable? Where is this stemming from? And how can I be bold and really have the heart and the will and the courage to make decisions and stick with it and get as many people to advocate for it and to support it?
Yeah, we touched on a lot of different things that I was looking at to discuss with you about HBCUs. And I kind of wanted to bring up one topic because we're talking about accountability and HBCUs being role models for social justice. And I came across a controversial topic, and also this feeds into the funding for the university as well, about diversifying HBCUs' enrollments. Obviously, there's already other students of color, not Black students, on the university campuses. But if they seek to actively enroll more white students, is that a good thing or a bad thing or really kind of neutral thing for HBCUs to integrate white students on their campuses?
I look forward to a day where that wouldn't even be a conversation. If no one's saying, what's going to happen if everybody that goes to Notre Dame is not Catholic? Mm-hmm. We don't say that. So that's so intense into the nation of who we are. I'm unapologetically Black. I'm very proud to work at a historically Black college, which will, as long as I am fortunate to serve in this position, which will stay true to its roots of honoring the history and the culture of Black people. My campus is 74% African-American and over 20%, at some point, even 25% Hispanic. We have a strong international component and we have white students. And I don't lay awake at night. Somehow that changes our mission. Because it doesn't. Just like at Notre Dame, we have non-Catholic students. It doesn't change their mission. It doesn't change who they are. If we have a school that is primarily for Jewish students or an all-female school or all-male school, that doesn't mean that you're losing anything. It just means that you're doing what you've always done, which is not discriminating. You know, I know most of my students. Now I don't because they've been away for a year, but I'm very engaged on campus. And I sit and talk to my brown students and I talk to my Black students and I talk to my white students and they're just happy to be here. And one of the white students said to me one time, something that really resonated with me, that he felt like it was the first time that he felt like he belonged to something. So that says something about the character of the school, the institution, and what young people look for. So I think we allow that kind of narrative to become critical and negative. I don't worry about that. I know all the presidents of the private HBCUs, and I know most of the presidents of the state institutions, because, you know, we're private and public. And all of us are very in tune to what our mission is, staying focused to our mission. And it's really to break generational poverty. And in this country, unfortunately, that is associated with race.
When I was looking at the information about HBCUs that the United Negro College Fund list that they had and how the HBCUs create a climate that fosters success for Black students because they are amongst other Black students and a lot of the faculty are Black. So it promotes great community like you've been talking about. And so I can imagine how that would be liberating for some Black students who have been in racist environments in their K through 12 schools, microaggressions, things like that, that happen to them on a daily basis, and to finally come into an environment where they are the majority and their culture surrounds them. So then to have a white student come into that environment and kind of disrupt that a little bit, it just gave me pause. But it also made me think, for the white students, it would be an awesome learning experience to be put into a place where they've never been before, and that is as the minority in a situation. And I was thinking that would be a great opportunity for the right white students to come into that environment and really learn something from it.
You know, that's probably another whole show.
Yeah.
I think we put that in them, young people, especially this generation, as opposed to it being in them. By that, I mean, my students wouldn't even really react to that. They just want to be people. Mm-hmm. And I think we as a nation carry that around. That's how it gets baked into people, because we perceive that that's how someone feels. I want us to get to a place where that's not a topic. And that's another thing about historically Black colleges. If you're, you know, a green student and you come here, you're just going to be one of our students. They're going to wrap you up and make you a part of the team like everybody else. They do that with each other because they really realize that even in their Blackness, there's a lot of differences. There's a lot of diversity. So they realize that we're not monolithic. We're very, very different people. And we want to just lean into our humanity, being proud of the skin that I'm in, but recognizing that I am equitable with everybody else. You're not better than me and I'm not better than you. I have different skills and strengths and weaknesses, but we all hurt. We all fear something, we all worry about something, and we all love something. And that is the beloved community that we're building.
Well, thank you so much for talking to us about Houston Tillotson. It's been great to get to know it a little bit better.
It's been a pleasure. Come and visit us. We are Austin's campus. I look forward to seeing everybody.
Thanks so much.
Thank you, Bob, and my fellow Buckeye.
Well, it's Friday afternoon, May 28th, and once again, we've got Austin Sanders with us here. Austin is a staff writer for the Austin Chronicle, covers APD, homelessness, Austin City Council, whole bunch of stuff. How you doing today, Austin?
I'm doing all right, Bob. Thanks for having me on.
Well, thank you, as always. So I know we're at kind of an in-between time here. And there's been a lot of noise made about sanctioned encampments. You know, what are we going to do with all these tents that are under the overpasses and street corners? A list of public places has been circulating, but I don't think there's been anything definitive on that yet. Staffers are about to report back to City Council. Is that where that stands at the moment?
As you mentioned, and we talked about, staff presented this list last week. Council just kind of really push back against it for a variety of reasons. And so they're due to report back with a more refined list, I think, but also how to pay for the operations at these sites to kind of hammer out more of the details before actually just even deciding where these campsites should go. But I think we have gotten a sense at this point just how much of a battle this is going to be between some neighborhoods, businesses, property owners, advocacy groups, and city council members who support the establishment of these encampments. As we talked about before, the reason that tents have popped up under overpasses and in parks is because there's nowhere else for people experiencing homelessness to go. Those are some of the most convenient, safest places for them to stay. So finding an agreeable alternative for the people living there and people who were bothered by their presence under overpasses and in parks is going to be a challenge. And I think we're getting a sense of that already.
So in the meantime, Save Austin Now, which was the group behind Proposition B, seems to have been emboldened by it all, and they've moved on to the next big thing.
Yeah, it seems like they've settled on a playbook on passing conservative policies in a reliably liberal Austin. It's to petition for these ordinances on ballots, just like Prop B was with the public camping, get them on the ballot in low turnout elections and raise a bunch of money from a small number of people and hope that you can kind of override the will of democratically elected local officials that way. So what they are doing now is they announced a new petition drive related to the police department. This ordinance would do a few things. The most notable would be requiring a specific level of staffing of sworn patrol officers. They would require 2 sworn patrol officers for every 1,000 residents in the city. This is kind of an arbitrary figure that's been debunked in studies as kind of meaningless and not really tied to any proven data that shows this ratio reduces crime or is any better at preventing crime. But one thing we know for sure is it would cost a lot of money. It would kind of put an anchor on the budget and the spending on police. Currently, the ratio is about 1.7 officers for every 1,000 residents in the city. And that may not sound like a lot, but it translates to millions of dollars every year if the city were to have to bump that up to 2.0 officers per 1,000. It would be millions more spent on policing every year when clearly the city council, through the voters that have elected them, are moving in a different direction. You know, as this trend we're seeing in cities across the country to try and de-emphasize the role of police officers in public safety and to kind of grow alternatives. So this petition effort would really put a damper on those efforts to kind of fund and invest in public safety alternatives, housing, other solutions that can really prevent crime by addressing root causes of crime.
So if it's not enough to be getting it from Save Austin Now, it seems like we're also getting it from the Texas legislature.
Yeah, exactly. That's kind of a familiar pattern every 2 years when the legislature is in session. There's always a number of bills that either target Austin or just cities in Texas generally. 2 of the big ones here are these bills, which are on their way to the governor's desk, aimed at punishing cities who, quote unquote, defund their police department. Obviously, this is clearly aimed at decisions by the Austin City Council to reduce the police budget last year. And frankly, Austin is really one of the only cities in the country to have done that. This is something that would affect a number of big cities in Texas. There are 2 bills, a House version and a Senate version. Both have advanced to the governor's desk. The House bill would impose financial penalties on any city with a population larger than 250,000 people that reduces their police department's budget compared to the previous fiscal year. So it's pretty straightforward. If you cut that money, you'll be unable to raise your property tax rate, and a portion of your sales tax revenue will have to go to the state comptroller, who will then funnel it to the Texas Department of Public Safety, the state police agency. The House bill will also allow any area in a city that has been annexed within the past 30 years to hold a disannexation election to basically break away from the city if they so choose. And then the Senate measure basically requires any county with a population over 1 million people to gain voter approval before reducing police spending, right? You have to hold an election to say, hey, we want to cut this much money from the police department to save money in the budget because we're in a recession or because we want to invest in other alternatives because policing is, you know, proven not to be the most effective way at reducing crime in areas. So these are, you know, 2 barriers that will make it much harder for this project that the city of Austin is calling reimagining public safety. It'll make it much harder for cities to kind of proceed with this effort, which of course is, you know, clearly the legislature and Governor Abbott's intent.
This is just amazing. I mean, considering this is all coming from the party that believes in local control, you know?
Right. That's pretty much a joke at this point, right? Which is
right.
One of the major complaints from municipal level officials is particularly the House bill, which imposes these financial penalties, it exerts so much control over the local budget process. If you are a mayor or a city council member, why would you ever vote to increase the police budget knowing that you could be penalized for decreasing it? You're basically locking in your city's taxpayers into whatever you increase the police budget to in perpetuity without getting permission from the governor's office. Yeah, it's a kind of new front in the battle against local control that we see, you know, pop up every legislative session.
Well, in the meantime, I guess we'll all just run out and buy ourselves guns and see where all that goes, right?
Right. Yeah. You won't need a license or any training pretty soon to buy a handgun. You won't be alone doing that.
Well, I appreciate your time here this afternoon. I hope you have a great Memorial weekend and look forward next week. We'll be having you and Mike Clark Madison and Beth Sullivan on to give us a wrap up for the ledge.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that. There are certainly some questions on the legality of these bills and some further kind of unintended consequences in Austin and other cities. I'm excited to talk with you and my colleagues about.
Well, we're all looking forward to that. In the meantime, enjoy the weekend and we'll talk to you next week.
Yeah, you have a happy Memorial Day. Thanks.
That's all for this evening. Thanks for listening. Stay safe, everyone, and have a good night.